It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
This is more about attitude and a nuanced change than it is about changing the actual principles of free speech. It's because we've developed this paranoia almost about anything related to terrorism. And I think there's this notion that terrorists take pictures before they plan their activities, and therefore there's a strong reaction to it.
Kent Willis, the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia, talks about the boundaries of free speech 10 years post 9/11. And during this week's News You Can Use, we talk about the Obama administration's plans to help the unemployed, but to harm cell phone users. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 143, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Buried in President Obama's deficit reduction plan is a proposal to allow debt collectors to contact debtors via their cell phones when collecting debts owed to or guaranteed by the federal government. But, according to the National Consumer Law Center, giving one of the most abusive industries in the U.S. free rein to inundate people with robocalls to their cell phones will distract people while driving, interrupt them at their jobs, and needlessly impose a cost on struggling families by using up scarce minutes. Currently, debt collection calls to cell phones are limited because collectors must check their phone number lists against a list of known cell phones and cannot call those numbers unless the consumer has provided that number as a way of reaching them. Though the proposal is limited to debts owed to or guaranteed by the federal government, millions of consumers will be affected, including graduates who can't pay their student loans, homeowners who are behind in mortgages, and people who are in tax disputes with the IRS. The Federal Trade Commission receives more complaints about the debt collection industry than any other industry, more than 140,000 complaints in 2010, and those complaints increase every year. In other news, last month, the National Employment Law Project received 250,000 petition signatures calling for an end to hiring practices that discriminate against the unemployed and to call for passage of the Fair Employment Opportunity Act. The bill, included in President Obama's American Jobs Act, would prohibit exclusion of the unemployed from job openings. Employers and staffing agencies that refuse to consider the unemployed for job openings have become a disturbing hurdle for jobless Americans looking for work. Ads on the nation's most heavily trafficked job posting websites like CareerBuilder.com and Monster.com regularly include messages like, "Must be currently employed." A June poll conducted by Hart Research Associates found that 90% of respondents agreed that excluding unemployed candidates from job opportunities is an unfair hiring policy. In a sign that some organizations are changing or clarifying their policies, earlier this month, Indeed.com, one of the largest job listing websites in the U.S., announced that it would stop posting job ads that refuse applications from unemployed candidates. For more than 30 months, there have been more than 4 unemployed workers for every job opening, and the average duration of joblessness now stands at 40 and a third weeks. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. You're listening to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio.
This week's case that changed the Commonwealth is United States versus Charlottesville RHA. In the 1980s, the Charlottesville Redevelopment and Housing Authority had a tenant selection policy giving preferential treatment to white applicants for public housing to achieve a 50-50 mix of black and white residents. Due to this, black applicants waited 2 to 3 times longer for housing than white applicants. The Regional Office of Housing and Urban Development commended the plan, but the United States Attorney's Office sued based upon racial discrimination. The federal court granted summary judgment for the United States, finding that the plan violated the Fair Housing Act. Because blacks had to wait longer, that was functionally equivalent to being denied the housing, and HUD lacked power to excuse discrimination. In addition, the plan was not narrowly tailored because it had a serious impact upon every black applicant for public housing in the area. This has been the law ever since. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Diane Dussault, and United States versus Charlottesville RHA is this week's case that changed the Commonwealth.
We're here at the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia in downtown Richmond, and we are talking with Kent Willis, the executive director of the ACLU of Virginia. And today we will be talking about free speech and free expression 10 years post 9/11. Welcome to the show, Kent.
I'm delighted to be here, Marty.
Nice to have you back, Kent. Now, in the post 9/11 era, I think it's important for people to understand what the boundaries, if any, to free speech are. Obviously, we all know that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. But beyond that, what are the boundaries of free speech?
The boundaries of free speech haven't changed since 9/11 in the sort of technical legal sense. The court cases that tell us what free speech is are still there and they're still intact. And what this means is that under the First Amendment of the Constitution, you have a right to express your opinion. You have a right to write books, to have your say. The question about having your say, of course, is where. And what the courts say is that in a public place, you can express your opinion. The only limits are, as you mentioned, something like fire in a theater and then obscenity. And obscenity is a complicated thing. Otherwise, your right to express your opinion about anything particularly related to the government is protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. What the courts have said is that the government can regulate your speech as long as those regulations are reasonable, time, place, and manner restrictions and not related to the viewpoint of your speech. And that's the issue. I mean, what we're really talking about here is people taking to public sidewalks or going to the park or expressing themselves in places like this, and when it is that the government can create restraints. Technically, that hasn't changed, but the truth is, based on a lot of ordinances, tweaks in the law, and sort of general attitude towards free speech, we are seeing a lot of restrictions taking place.
Now, I wanted to talk about some specific incidents that are possibly related to this post 9/11 fear. And one of them was the fellow up in Northern Virginia whose camera was confiscated at Reagan National Airport. Would you tell us about that?
This was a man who wanted to take pictures. He's an amateur photographer, and he wanted to take pictures at National Airport inside the terminal. He decided, given everything, he would call ahead and make sure it was okay. He called ahead and was told by the people he talked to there that it was perfectly fine to do it. By the way, in our opinion, he didn't need to call ahead. He was going into a public space where thousands of people carry cameras and take pictures every day. So he went there, he started taking pictures, and the next thing he knew, he was being essentially chased down by the security personnel. They took his camera, they took out the flash card in his camera that enabled him to keep those pictures, and they confiscated it. Our notion is that this is a public space, and in a public space, you have a right to take a picture. The only thing we've heard that might be a reasonable restriction on cameras in an airport, and this guy did not violate this rule, is taking pictures where you can actually see the x-ray pictures of people's belongings. In other words, if you were there in the security line and you were taking a picture that would enable you to see inside someone else's suitcase, that's a problem. And so we have no issue with the security guards preventing people from taking pictures in that secure area. But the rest of the airport is a public space. People have taken pictures in airports for 100 years probably, but no one cared about it until now.
And why do they care about it now?
This is more about attitude and a nuanced change than it is about change in the actual principles of free speech. It's because we've developed this paranoia almost about anything related to terrorism. And I think there's this notion that terrorists take pictures before they plan their activities, and therefore there's a strong reaction to it.
Let's talk about another incident where a man in Norfolk recently was arrested for filming the police. From what you've said, taking a photograph, unless it's of a sensitive military site that nobody would have access to anyway, is protected free speech, free expression. What happened here?
Again, this is the same sort of thing that we wouldn't see happening, I think, 10 or 12 years ago. This was a man who was attending a demonstration in Norfolk, and he was filming it. It just so happened, as he was filming it, the police came. And it's uncertain as to exactly what was happening. Maybe the demonstration had gotten too large. Maybe they were outside the boundaries. But the police arrived. He simply was continued filming as the police arrived. They saw that someone was filming them in a public place doing their job for the public. And they took his camera away. We're going to argue that he had an absolute right to be sitting there with that camera in a public place, taking a picture of the police or anyone else, and that if they tried to prevent him from doing that, they were the ones in the wrong, not him.
We're talking with Kent Willis. He is the executive director of the ACLU of Virginia, and I'd like to talk about the Virginia Fusion Center. First of all, what exactly is a fusion center?
Fusion centers are creatures of 9/11. They did not exist before. Most states have them now. They are federal, state, and local agency organizations. And the idea is that anyone that sees an activity that appears to be a terrorist activity in law enforcement is supposed to report it to this agency. So it accumulates all this information. And all the accumulated information is supposed to enable us to determine whether there or not there are terrorist activities. It's a theory. The problem with the Fusion Center, as far as we can tell, is that there's a kind of over-exuberance for its job, and there's a kind of sort of paranoia that develops if you're kind of in this little bubble of activity where everything starts to look like terrorism.
Well, one of the things about the Fusion Center report, this came out a couple of years ago, is it described Virginia's universities and colleges as, quote, nodes for radicalization. Would you care to expand on that?
It's one of the most astonishing, maybe mind-boggling aspects of the report is that what it seemed to do was to demographically go around the state, any place where it found a fair number of universities and any place where it found a fair number of minorities, it described as nodes of radicalization. In other words, we should fear any place where there are a lot of students and a lot of minorities. That's sort of scary stuff. It's stereotyping. There's no basis for that. But this is the message that the Fusion Center is sending to law enforcement people across the state. Be careful wherever you see students. Be careful wherever you see racial minorities, because those are likely to be places for terrorism.
And we're talking about anything from Virginia Union University to the University of Virginia Charlottesville, as I understand.
Absolutely. A place like Richmond was pointed out to be a particular node of radicalization because it had not only a lot of students, but a lot of minority students. And Norfolk was the same way. But this targeted students of any kind on the assumption, maybe a very old assumption, maybe an assumption from the 60s, maybe one out of the imagination of the people at the Fusion Center, that somehow if you're a student, you're a radical.
Well, and now talking about students, that's a great segue to the recent Banana Man incident up in Fredericksburg. Could you tell our listeners about the Banana Man incident?
One of the areas in general where we've seen a significant and unreasonable crackdown on freedom of expression is schools. There's a case going back to the 1960s that says, by the way, students who go to public schools don't lose their free speech rights when they cross through the schoolhouse door. They still have a right of freedom of expression. They just can't do it in a way that materially disrupts the educational process. Of course, a student in a classroom can't stand up and just say whatever they want. The teacher has a right to control the classroom and the subject matter. But otherwise, students, whether it's protest, whether it's campaign buttons, whatever it is like that, unless it's causing a disturbance, have a right to free speech. So we know that as a basic principle. And that seemed to have worked well in schools for a long time. But what we've seen since 9/11 is schools using this disruption principle to further and further crack down. Again, it's like I was saying before, there hasn't been a change in the legal principles guiding what free speech in public schools is, but there's been a change in the behavior. The Banana Man episode is a good example of a bad development. A young man decided at a high school football game in Spotsylvania County to, at halftime, run around the sidelines in a banana suit that he had. It didn't seem to be related to anything. It's not like the high school mascot was a banana or anything. It's just that he decided this. So he did it, and I think a lot of people got a good laugh out of it.
And I understand the student himself had Asperger's syndrome, which I believe is a part of the autism spectrum.
There are a couple of issues here, because the school's reaction to his doing this was to suspend him immediately, and then the principal was recommending expulsion for the rest of the year. Schools have a lot of authority to make these kinds of decisions. The first isn't this an overreaction if anybody were doing it? The second one, with this particular issue, if this student has a disability, then the school is required to accommodate him based on those disabilities. So this immediate overreaction to a student with a disability is just way out of proportion to what you would have seen 10 or 15 years ago. So first you had this overreaction to a student who clearly broke a rule. It's the kind of thing that probably would have been laughed about 10 or 15 years ago, but now school suspends him for breaking a rule, because I'm guessing you're not supposed to run around the edge of the football field during halftime. Of course, the free speech incident that developed out of that is very interesting, and that's where we really entered the picture. On the Monday after the football game, students showed up at school wearing yellow T-shirts, and they were with those yellow T-shirts. Some had writing on them and some didn't. I think the ones that had writing said, "Free Banana Man." And the idea was that they were protesting the overreaction of the school in suspending this young man for this very minor violation of rules. It still surprises me to this day, based on the law and based on what I've seen in 20 years here at the ACLU, when school officials so completely overreact. What the school officials did with the students was confiscate the T-shirts, tell the students they would be punished if they wore them again, and essentially completely censored their free speech rights by telling them that the T-shirts would not be allowed in school.
And again, I thought that incident, that whole legal issue, had been settled 40 years ago with the anti-Vietnam War protest. Why did the school principal, who I understand later resigned over this, why did the school principal just not get it?
I still don't understand that. I think that it's very easy to understand this issue of how much free speech students are allowed in schools, and this was a case where they clearly were allowed. But in general, it's the kind of overreaction we see over and over again, and we've seen it more since 9/11 than before.
And I guess the last incident I want to talk about an overreaction, is one that occurred in late July at the office of Congressman Eric Cantor, and this involved one of the founders of WRIR. This was a letter-writing campaign that was organized by Move.org, and it was to assemble people at the congressman's office, which is in a private space, Innsbruck, but it's a public congressman's office, to basically write letters protesting the possible, what turned out, averted debt default of the United States. And during that campaign, the WRIR founder speculated that the debt default crisis needed to be averted to avert people becoming more and more desperate, because desperate people could do desperate things. They could remember their high school chemistry. That throwing cornstarch into water could gum up the public water supply, or that putting metal shavings into a power station could gum up the electrical supply. And the next thing he knew, having said these are things that could happen, he was being questioned by two Henrico County police officers, and later questioned by Innsbruck Private Security, and later banned from Innsbruck.
This is the same kind of overreaction that is the sort of thing we see now that we didn't used to see so much. Under the principles of free speech, he had a right to make those observations in a public place. There's the fire in the theater question here, but that is nowhere near what he was saying. He has a right to make those speculative remarks. What he doesn't have a right to do is to create a riot on the spot. It has to be something that's imminent, that's going to cause problems of public safety. This was nothing but a statement about things that could happen. It is totally protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. The reaction was an overreaction. That the speech took place on property that was not a traditional public forum, like a park or a sidewalk, creates a legal issue. Private property, even these sidewalks in front of malls and shopping centers, or that are part of the shopping center, are privately owned space, and so the people that own that space can control what people do and what people say in that space. So the fact that he has been banned from a space that looks to us like public space, but is in actuality private space, means that they legally can get away with this. By the way, some states have recognized this particular issue. They've noticed that there's a proliferation of shopping malls and places like that, but a disappearance of traditional town centers and sidewalks. And so what they have done is said, at a place like Short Pump Town Center, even though that's privately owned space, because it has all the makings of a public space, that people can actually exercise their free speech rights there. Some have done this through state constitutions. Some have done it through state laws. Virginia has not done it. We have tried to get the legislature to look at free speech differently in these kinds of places, but they haven't done that yet. And we've tried to get the courts to recognize it, and they haven't done it yet.
And in this particular instance, even though Innsbruck is privately owned, they are leasing space to a public figure, and that lease presumably is paid with public tax dollars. Would that change the analysis that even if someone could be banned from Innsbruck for whatever reason, that they can't be banned from space that is leased by a public official?
I wish that were the case, because it is a problem. The public officials get to hide themselves away in plain sight, in a way. They can put themselves there in a shopping center. They can put their sign up so everybody can see them, and then they can say, aha, we control this space. The right to be able to protest on the sidewalk or parking lot in front of a congressman's office just ought to be a law. It ought to say, yes, you can do that. Right now, that right does not exist. If you're in that space, the owners of the space get to determine who can be there and who can't, and can even determine what you say and don't say.
I guess the lesson here is you have to be in a true public space, a public road, a public sidewalk, perhaps with a sign with huge font so that at least it could be read from the congressman's office.
Right. Well, and particularly in suburban locations, this is a big problem. The building is owned by the company that owns the shopping mall. The parking lot is owned by them, and often there are no public sidewalks. There are no sidewalks in a lot of suburban areas. The next thing is the street, and you don't have a right to stand in the street. And so, in effect, your ability to have any proximity to the public figure that you are protesting or whose actions you're protesting is eliminated entirely. And it's why a lot of organizations, particularly the ACLU, have been part of a movement to try to start to recognize these spaces as something different. They're not traditional public spaces, they're not private spaces, and there need to be different rules that apply to them. But so far, in Virginia in particular, we failed to do that.
I can see there's certainly work to be done. Thank you very much. We have been talking with Kent Willis. He is the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia, and we have been talking about free speech and free expression in the post 9/11 era. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
This week's Strange But True Law is from Title 30, which deals with the General Assembly. Code of Virginia Section 30-5 says that any party or attorney in any action or proceeding in any court or agency who is a member of the General Assembly shall be entitled to a postponement as a matter of right starting 30 days before the General Assembly session and ending 30 days after the General Assembly. No pleading or action can be required during this period. However, this does not apply to granting, extending, or ending a temporary injunction. So, if you want a temporary injunction against a party or attorney in the General Assembly, January and February are really good times to do it. For the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, I'm Michelle King, and that's this week's Strange But True Law.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio show ever broadcast is now available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral four, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. The National Celebration of Pro Bono Law officially takes place during the last week of October each year. Join us next week when Central Virginia Legal Aid Society's Executive Director Steve Dickinson describes how financially distressed and vulnerable citizens in Central Virginia receive much-needed legal service as a result of the week. That's law for the rest of us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.